Hey, Anna, I want you to think back to the year 1990. What were you doing in 1990?
I was in third grade.
No, you were not.
I was.
Oh my gosh, you're so young.
Yeah, ridiculous. I was going to say, I can't help that you're old.
Back when I was old in 1990, a certain telescope was launched into space in the of the space shuttle. Mm-hmm. And so 1990, the Hubble Space Telescope went into operation. And as you were in your third grade classroom, I'm sure your elementary school teacher showed you these great pictures from the Hubble telescope.
She probably did, actually. Yeah. I really liked my third grade teacher.
Oh, I mean, and then you had them plastered on your walls.
Right.
You had posters of them everywhere.
That's
you had
right.
the Eagle Nebula.
Forget new kids. Oh, yeah. I had the Hubble telescope.
Yeah, you just put them right over Justin Timberlake. Or how old was he?
I guess he was he's my age.
He was probably third grade, too.
Oh, my God. How old are you?
Well, you know.
We need to work on your pop culture.
In space time,
timeline.
You know, when you space time, I got to figure out how to answer that question. But
that's right.
Anyway, from the studios of Cincinnati Public Radio, I'm Dean Regas, and this is Looking Up.
And I'm Anna Heeman, and we're both from the Cincinnati Observatory. Dean's the astronomer, and I'm asking him the questions. In this episode, Dr. Amber Strawn from NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center joins us to talk Hubble and Webb telescopes. So, 1990. They launched. That feels a long time ago,
to
tell you.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing, is that the technology. Think of the technology that was in that telescope in 1990. I mean, they sent up some upgrades. That was the plus, is that the Hubble telescope was, you know, serviceable, that it was reachable by the astronauts.
Right.
And of course, it did mess up when they first put it up there, which I just would have hated to have been down on the down on the ground when they're like, let's get the first picture back from Hubble. This is going to be sweet. I can't wait. And then it's all grainy and blurry. It looks like somebody's finger is in front of it.
It's like teaching your dad to take a selfie or
That's
something.
Right. That's
You're
right.
like, oh no.
That's right.
No offense, Dad. You're
and
doing
so,
a great job.
So luckily, they were able to go up and fix it. And so they've done some upgrades to it and everything. But still, it has some pretty old technology.
Yeah. But it's, I mean, the images are so beautiful. I mean, I think it's such a cool thing that it's, and it's still kicking. It's you do you, Hubble. That's amazing.
That's right. That's right. And I mean, these pictures that it sent back, and that's the thing, is this is an optical telescope. So it's going to make all these great, pretty pictures. And so we get these pictures of planets, of galaxies, of nebulas, and all these beautiful colors that it's bringing out. And I think, more than any telescope in history, that one has really kind of stood the test of time.
Oh, for sure. You know, I want to talk about the time that the person at the observatory asked me.
What did they ask you?
They asked me if our telescope was the Hubble telescope.
Oh my gosh.
And I was new, and I was like, no. You know, I was pretty confident.
Yeah.
And then this person said, are you sure? And I just was like, I almost got my phone out. And then I was like, I'm not getting my phone out. I know definitively. I don't know much.
Right.
But this ain't the Hubble telescope,
The Hubble Space Telescope is not the one on ground.
And he was like, no.
No. Yeah. They built it in 1845.
Oof,
it's sitting in Cincinnati. That's where it is
Sitting here
now.
Orbiting.
Yeah. Right.
That's what I think of now.
You did a nice answer. That's what a teacher, how they would answer. Good question.
Right.
I'll have to think about that. No.
But then later I did laugh.
Yeah.
I'm still laughing.
Well,
it's been like 3 years.
You know.
Does that mean?
There are no bad questions, but that was pretty close.
But when you push it, then I sort of get a little like, I told you it's not.
Right.
Like, don't
you.
Try to make me feel like
right.
it. Okay. Anyway, we have old telescopes at the observatory.
Right, right.
And that can't see what Hubble can see.
No, not even close. That's the thing. So, our telescope at the observatory is only 11 inches in diameter, and the Hubble telescope is 8 feet in diameter.
So larger.
Yes, that is correct. Slightly larger.
I'm just using my man skills.
That's right. Yes, I should have used inches for the whole thing. But
but that would have been a better
Or millimeters or... that'd
fancy.
Be worse.
Okay.
We couldn't get that one.
So much bigger.
Much bigger.
Yes.
Much better technology.
Mm-hmm.
Put cameras on it and beam the images and beam the data back down. And then the astronomers and engineers like put all the data together into these beautiful pictures that we see.
Yeah.
So our telescope is the old style one.
Mm-hmm.
That's for sure. And so I think I've asked this before, but, when was the first telescope made? Ballpark.
Why are you asking? Shouldn't I be asking you that?
Oh, right. Okay. Ask me that question.
Have you forgotten the dynamic here?
I forgot the answer, so I was hoping you were going to answer it for me.
This is going to be like, I'm supposed to vamp or something? No. I have no idea. The first telescope was made a bit ago.
That is correct.
That's my final answer.
Yes. 1608 is the official date of when the first one was patented and shown to the government official to say, hey, look, I made a telescope. I'm first, right? And it was a guy named Hans Lipperhey that did it.
Great name.
Dutch guy. And he said, yeah, I made a telescope. Here it is. I want a patent. And they're like, you'd think that would be pretty cool. Everybody'd be like, yeah, wow.
Give the man the patent.
You look through the telescope, you see stuff far away. Mm-hmm. And but the patent office said, nope, you don't get a patent because other people already have telescopes. I saw them. They're out and around and anybody can make them. You didn't make it first.
Is that for real?
Yeah. And so his patent was denied, and people were arguing with him, like, I did mine first, and my granddaddy made one back in 1535 and all this stuff.
Why did the Dutch have southern accents?
Oh, sorry. Well, they're in the country.
Oh, my bad. Okay, go ahead. This is really good.
So they even had fights over it. They're broken telescopes over this, like who had the first one.
But still,
Hans Lipperhey gets credit because he went to the office, to the government office first. So he had, it was like publish or perish kind of thing.
So people had it, but they hadn't asked for the credit.
Exactly.
I get you, Hans. I see you.
But yeah, within a year after 1608, there are telescopes all around Europe. Like we think of Europe as being kind of like, well, in the Middle Ages, maybe there wasn't a lot going on or a lot of intellectual stuff. But yeah, telescopes were in, you know, Italy and Germany and Paris in 1 year. And then Galileo gets his idea and he makes his own in like a day.
Your boy, Galileo.
You think, like, you know, nobody's made one before 1608, but yet it's really easy to make one. And, like, you know.
It's interesting.
Yeah. So then after that, they just get bigger and bigger because that's what you do. When you get one scope, you got to get a bigger one.
Absolutely.
and so they get these monstrous sizes. So, like, they start off, you can hold them in your arm, then you can, like, put them on a stand. And then these guys.
Need a horse and buggy to grab.
The Huygens brothers make one that's over 150 feet long. Like, think our telescope.
Wait, 150 feet? Like, the tube is 150 feet long?
150 feet long between the end of the lens and the eyepiece where they looked.
And that was the first log flume. Never mind. Like, that's like, you could just, like, that's what I'm thinking of. I'm sorry. That's not what it is.
It was ridiculous size. And so the Huygens brothers basically were like, yeah, so we made this giant telescope. We can move it with the help of four strong men and aim it up at the stuff. And their view was...
was not as good as just the regular.
It was still the best, but it was not up to today's standards.
Bigger's not always better.
Well, longer was.
Or longer's not always better. Okay.
But it was mostly they got better technology, and so then they can make mirrors and lenses a lot more accurate and pristine, so you could see these things so much better. And so then you get up to bigger scopes like one called the Leviathan.
I love that name.
Yes.
That's cool.
The Leviathan of Parsontown. It sounds like a,
you know, like a
sea monster. It's going to come get you.
Something bad.
It's a giant telescope in Ireland that started the same year our telescope did, 1845, and it had this giant mirror on it that's like 6 feet in diameter.
Okay.
So you could actually stand up in the tube. That's how big the telescope is.
Pass.
That sounds
terrifying.
No? You don't want to be in the tube of the telescope?
That sounds like, I mean, with it all around you?
Yeah.
That sounds like a nightmare. Just baking, just waiting,
that's
just
true.
Like,
that's true. Just if the sun comes in, you'd be in big trouble.
That's true. Actually, yeah, I was thinking like, yeah, you would, oh man, you're just like stuck down there, like a little, okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, everybody's got their thing. That's
fine. So I think we need a nickname for our telescope.
Oh, yeah.
The Leviathan's pretty good.
That is like.
We need something a little more beautiful sounding instead of less menacing. But anyway, we'll let the listeners come up with some ideas of.
Now I can't think of anything else.
Yeah.
We have to stop.
Yeah. But anyway, so then we get into even bigger telescopes. Like then you get into the one called the Palomar Observatory. That's
Palomar.
200 inches in diameter is the mirror. So it's one giant mirror, 200 inches across. And
that's
that,
like 10 feet across? Someone help me fact check me on this.
Again, 200.
Well, it's 12.
It's a lot.
Forget it. Whatever.
We can't do it on air. No. It's not going to work.
It's
big.
I was told there'd be no man. Right.
And then you get into even bigger ones, like the Keck telescopes are up in Hawaii are these segmented mirrors. There's like series of mirrors that they put together that are 40 feet across.
Mm-hmm.
And
jeez.
And then you get radio telescopes that are 100 feet across or 1,000 feet across. And I got to visit one in Green Bank, West Virginia. Mm-hmm. It is the largest movable object in the world.
The largest movable object in the world.
Yes. So it's a humongous radio telescope. And when you're standing next to it.
Does it look like a telescope?
It looks like a big radio antenna. It looks like your DirecTV satellite
it's
dish.
It's like a giant boombox.
Yeah. That's right. It's hearing.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not that kind of radio.
Cool.
Right. You put your headphones on. You're like, yeah, man, I could rock out to this.
You're like, I can hear this perfectly.
Yes.
This is great speaker.
Okay. Not quite like that.
Okay,
but
fine.
But still, it is so cool to check out. And you can go visit it and actually drive up next to it. And when it moves, it doesn't make a noise. So you have this gigantic monument-sized mountain moving, rotating around, aiming, tilting different directions, and it makes no sound whatsoever.
That is terrifying.
It was a little bit, because I was standing
next to
it. Oh,
because you're there.
I was about to lean up against it, and I was talking to the astronomer. I was about to lean, and then it's like started moving. I was
casually
like,
casually,
it's moving.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
And they have one person that manages, or like they have like a team that manages it.
I actually never saw the people working it. It's like maybe they work it with their minds. I don't
know.
Yeah,
that's the only possible solution.
Must be some, no, they had a control panel.
they had control one of those remote controls. Well, that's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So now we're into the era of space telescopes.
Yeah.
And man, I can't wait to be hearing a little bit about the James Webb telescope.
Oh, yeah.
There is no denying the amazing advancements in astronomy that the Hubble telescope has been responsible for since launching way back in 1990. But its days are winding down and a new and exciting space telescope is preparing to launch. Joining us to talk about Hubble's legacy and the promise of the Webb telescope is Dr. Amber Strawn, astrophysicist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, deputy project scientist for James Webb Space Telescope Science Communications, and the associate director of the Astrophysics Science Division. Amber, thanks so much for joining us today.
Sure, you're welcome. It's great to be here.
So how did you get into this very exciting field and working for NASA?
Oh, boy. Well, it started pretty early on in my life. I actually grew up in rural Arkansas on a tiny little farm in the middle of nowhere. And so the really beautiful dark sky sort of captured my imagination as a kid. And ultimately, that road led to NASA.
Really? So were there some objects that you saw? Did you get a telescope as a kid or...
Yeah, so it was mostly just naked eye observing for most of my childhood. I finally got my first telescope when I was in high school and then got to do a little bit more in-depth observing. But it was mostly just, looking at the stars with my eyes and dragging my family out to see meteor showers and eclipses and things like that. And then, of course, when I was in elementary school, the Hubble telescope launched, and that was... a huge deal. Even as a kid, I was following along the story of the Hubble, and of course, it had the flaw in the mirror, and there was all this drama, and then the astronauts went and fixed it, and it was this great success story, and it still is today.
That's so cool that you were ignited with this love for space and science and kind of talking about Hubble, since the James Webb Telescope is such an exciting project as well. Can you tell us a little bit about the kind of timeline for the Webb Telescope launch?
Yeah, so right now at NASA and at Northrop Grumman, we are in sort of the final stages of testing of the telescope. And that's going on right now. The telescope itself, the observatory, is sort of in two different halves right now. So there's the giant 6.5 meter mirror and instruments are one piece. And then the second piece is the spacecraft and the gigantic tennis court size sun shield. So those are in two pieces, and they will sometime next year come together. And both of those will be tested together as one giant observatory over the next couple of years. And then launch is currently scheduled for no earlier than March of 2021.
Okay. All right. Well, you mentioned some large sizes of mirrors and sun shields. How does the James Webb Telescope compare to Hubble?
Yeah, so Hubble as an observatory is roughly the size of a school bus. The mirror on Hubble is 2.4 meters, so, you know, a little taller than an average person. The mirror on Webb, as I mentioned, is 6.5 meters, so it's about 22 feet across. So area-wise, the Webb mirror is about 6.5, 7 times more area, bigger area than the Hubble mirror. And then Webb, in general, its size, I mentioned the sun shield's about the size of a tennis court, to give you a sense of scale. And it stands between 3 and 4 stories tall. So Webb is just structurally much, much bigger. As I mentioned, it's the biggest telescope that we've ever sent to space. Much bigger than Webb, and of course a bigger mirror. And the detector technology, of course, has improved a lot since Hubble. And so all those elements combined, the size of the mirror, the new detectors, the wavelength that it will observe, all those combined will end up giving us an observatory that's about 100 times more powerful than Hubble, if you can imagine that. It's going to be awesome. Wow.
So, I mean, you're not going to, like, I'm reading between the lines here, but you would never say this, but you'd say the James Webb telescope's going to make the Hubble look like a microscope, right? Is that what you're saying?
I would never say that.
Never.
Don't trash talk the Hubble.
She didn't say it. I did.
Yeah, that's a good point. So she's defending it. Yeah.
It's sort of hard to imagine, because Hubble has just been this beacon of discovery for NASA and really for the world, for humanity. But as awesome as it has been, you know, there's a lot of ways in which we've pushed it to its limits, and there are just some things that Hubble just can't do. And it really is those things that has driven us to build Webb to answer those questions that Hubble just can't quite get to.
And that's a really exciting prospect. And can you tell us a little bit more about kind of where it's going to be in space and how long it's going to be up there and how far from Earth and some of those details?
Sure. Yeah. So that's another one of the key differences between Hubble and Webb, besides just the sheer size difference between the two. So Hubble orbits the Earth. Fairly close. It's only Hubble's about 350 miles up, and it orbits the Earth once every 90 minutes or so. So it's relatively nearby, which is, of course, why astronauts could easily get to it to service it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's Hubble. So Webb is much different in that it will be much further away. So Webb will end up being about 1 million miles from Earth.
Whoa.
So that's about 4 times further away than the moon. Yep. And Webb will orbit the sun sort of in line with the Earth. If you can imagine that orbit of the Earth around the sun, Webb will be orbiting around the sun along with the Earth. So it's going to be far away. And the reason for that is that Webb is an infrared telescope.
Mm-hmm.
So Webb sees the universe in light that is just a little bit more red than what your eyes can detect. And so, and you can kind of think of infrared light sort of like heat radiation. So you go outside on a warm, sunny day like it is today here in the Washington, D.C. area, and you feel that warmth on your skin. That's infrared light from the sun. And, of course, we can't see that light with our eyes, but we can build detectors to see infrared light. And so Webb will be an infrared detecting telescope, but because it is sort of like heat radiation, we need the telescope itself, the detectors, the mirrors, everything about the telescope to be very, very cold, because otherwise it would glow. If it's warm, it's going to glow in infrared light, and it would sort of see itself. So we want the mirrors and everything to be super cold, so that it will only detect the infrared signatures from the distant universe.
Well, now you did mention the problem with Hubble. If there's a problem with the Webb telescope, God forbid, knock on desk or whatever, can it be repairable in space?
So there is not a plan to be able to service the Webb telescope. So, of course, humans have never been that far away. As I mentioned, Webb will end up being about 4 times further away than the moon. So right now there's no plan to send, you know, would be no plan to send humans to fix it. Right now there would be, there's no plan to send even like a robotic mission to fix it. And so one of the reasons that the mission has taken, I mean, it's been in development for a long time. And one of the reasons for that is because we have an extremely extensive test program here on the ground to make sure everything works like it's supposed to once it gets to space. Because you're right, we can't go fix it. Now, like you said, everybody, when you think of Hubble, at least in my mind, I sort of always, you know, imagine Hubble with the astronauts up around it fixing it. And that was a really cool sort of fun feature of Hubble. Hubble was designed that way. Hubble was designed to be sort of modular, where astronauts could go up and slide one instrument out and put another one in. So that was in the initial design of the Hubble telescope. But Hubble has been the only telescope that we've sent to space that has been designed like that. So all of the other telescopes and satellites that we use for science, so like the Chandra telescope and Spitzer, you know, all of those have been more in the web category of weren't designed to be serviceable. And you know, all the other satellites that we sort of depend on for our day-to-day life, for GPS and that sort of thing, you know, those aren't serviceable. So, you know, we're building web to work like it needs to. And we're testing it and retesting it to make sure that everything goes right once it's in space.
That's great. That makes a lot of sense. It's going to be a million miles away. It's going to be tricky to, yeah. So you mentioned that, you know, Hubble's kind of, as it winds down its mission, or what's the future of the actual telescope, and kind of, can you tell us a little bit about that, or what's going to happen with it?
Sure. So right now Hubble is working great. I mean, it's lasted, I think, a lot longer than a whole lot of people expected.
Sure.
And of course, one of the reasons it has lasted so long is because it has been serviced several times. The last servicing mission was in 2009, so that was quite a while ago.
Oh, wow,
now.
It's been that long.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it has been quite a while. But you know, Hubble is working great right now. Its instruments are doing good. It's still, you know, routinely taking data. And so we, NASA, intend to keep using Hubble for, you know, right now. We don't see any, you know, any imminent end in sight for Hubble.
Oh, cool.
And I think, you know, every couple of years, existing NASA missions go through reviews to see how they're doing, to see how the scientific productivity is. And, you know, with Hubble, every time it goes through these reviews, it's like, of course, it's super productive. You know, it's putting out data every day. It has a huge archive. I mean, even data taken a long time ago is still being used to make discoveries. And so Hubble is in good health, and we intend to keep using it, you know, as long as we can. Of course, we can't go back to fix it. There are no plans to, you know, to service Hubble again. But it's doing great. The orbit is stable and all of that. So we'll keep using Hubble.
Oh, that makes me happy, because I was envisioning the Webb scope as like the Buzz Lightyear to the Hubble's Woody. And like, you were just going to get rid of
Hubble.
They were
going to launch and just knock it out of the way, like bumper cars, basically. Well, that's what they were going
to
do.
Sorry, Hubble. Like, why don't you go to the telescope retirement home? I didn't know.
No, they could have both of them working at the same time.
No, I
it's
like
amazing.
That. Oh, I'm so happy. I feel like Hubble, you know, let's keep it up there. Good plan.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, and of course, astronomers, including myself, you know, we want both of those observatories working together, because they have, you know, separate capabilities. As I mentioned, Webb is an infrared telescope, and it has a little capability in the optical, you know, visible light range. But Hubble is primarily an optical visible light telescope, but it also has capability in the ultraviolet part of the spectrum. And so in that sense, it is extremely complementary to the science that Webb will do. And so having the two observatories together will be awesome, and we certainly hope that that will be the case.
Well, we're really excited about the James Webb Telescope. Best of luck with all of it, and we'll be keeping an eye and waiting for the launch date.
Great. Thanks. Us too.
All right. Thanks so much, Amber.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
We've been talking with NASA astrophysicist and project scientist for the James Webb Space Telescope, Dr. Amber Strawn.
So You know, we sometimes talk about fun kids questions on the podcast, and usually it's ones that maybe you get or our other, you know, educators get, but this is one that I got.
It came directly to you?
It came to me.
God, awesome.
This poor kid. It was so excited.
It wasn't the kid that said, is that the Hubble telescope?
No,
is
that was
the
a Hubble grown telescope? Man. I need you to know that.
Is that trash can the Hubble telescope? Is that like...
it's cylindrical.
That's right.
So this was from an outreach, and this little kiddo wanted to be an astronomer. It was really exciting. He knew about nebula, and he was very exciting and telling me a lot. And then actually he said, you know, why – are you ready for this? Because I'm going to ask you now. Because I was like, ooh, right. Kid, rain check on this one.
Okay.
Why don't Venus and Mercury have moons?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
All kid, the other
I was like,
planets...
they do. And then I was like, no, they don't. You're right.
All the other planets have moons. That's for sure.
Why don't they get them?
Earth's got one. Mars has two.
Jupiter's got 41.
79.
Yeah,
now.
Right.
Saturn, 62.
Mm-hmm.
Uranus, 27.
Dang.
And Neptune, 14.
Why can't they share?
Exactly. Why do they have all the moons and Mercury and Venus don't have any? And Earth only has one and Mars has two. And well, the story behind the moons, they're all different stories. They're all different origins. Like Mars has two moons because it captured two moons. These were wandering asteroids that were just coming too close to Mars. And then they got captured
and
by
Mars
the,
called dibs.
And Mars like, got them, mine, and mine.
Sorry, Earth.
Yeah. Earth got ours from a completely different way. It wasn't from capturing it. You know, it wasn't like the moon was wandering by and it lassoed it in. No. It
you
was,
don't say.
It was created by a giant object running into the Earth, breaking off a piece of the Earth, and that formed into the moon. And that's very scary,
that's
actually.
Terrifying.
It's terrifying to imagine the young early moon still or young early Earth that's still molten and something the size of Mars runs into us and breaks off a whole chunk of the Earth.
Yeah, stop recapping it. I got it.
You want it, should I do it again?
No.
Okay, well,
absolutely
twice
not.
Enough?
This is a real uplifting,
right.
You know, for this inquisitive astronomer.
So
astronomer.
We might not have had a moon if that catastrophic event didn't happen. So there was no similar catastrophic event to happen to Venus and nothing to Mercury similar that created the similar situation. And nothing crossed paths and got in the gravity well of those two planets. So, but there's also another factor is that Mercury and Venus are much closer to the sun, and the sun's gravity is definitely throws a monkey wrench into this stuff. And it's thought by a lot of astronomers that the sun's presence kind of makes it a lot harder for moons to form around these inner planets.
Yeah.
But there was all these theories that maybe these planets had moons in the past. And there are even some fake sightings of people thinking they saw moons around Venus and Mercury. All turned out to be untrue. Could be a crank file, actually. Now that I think about it, the fake moons of Venus that aren't really there. So that's the whole story: is that every planet has its own kind of situation with moons, and it just hasn't happened for Venus and Mercury like
that's
it did
really
for us.
Sad.
Like the tragic thing that
like
happened to us.
That is actually like, yeah, wow. That's,
but from that
I'm
violent
thinking about
explosion.
That for days.
But yeah, now you can look up at the moon and be like, yeah, that's
could
a
happen
piece
again.
Of the Earth.
That's what I'm thinking.
No, no, well, no, nah.
Oh my God, I'm done.
Nah, children out there, nah, it wouldn't happen again.
He's nodding at me. It's like, couldn't happen.
That's right.
That's it for this episode of Looking Up. Thanks so much to Dr. Amber Strawn from NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center for joining us. You can find a link to the James Webb Space Telescope on our website, wvxu.org/lookingup.
We definitely appreciate you listening and would love to hear from you. You can drop us a note with a topic or guest ideas or questions about space on Facebook or Twitter or email us at lookingup@wvxu.org.
Parents, we hope you'll share Looking Up with your kids and send us any questions they may have. Or if you have questions, we want to hear those too.
You can subscribe to Looking Up wherever you listen to podcasts and give us a rating and comment on Apple Podcasts. If you're new to Looking Up, you can always find all of our past episodes at wvxu.org/lookingup.
Our theme song and additional music is by Y. That's W-H-Y ? From their album Moline, courtesy of Joyful Noise Recordings and Terror Bird Media.
Looking Up is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. Kevin Reynolds is our producer, Josh Elstro is our engineer, and Jim Nolan provides additional technical assistance.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Anna Heeman.
And I'm Dean Regas. Keep looking up.